side of the big truss. Sooner or later, it would probably be used for overflow storage or sleeping quarters. Dube passed through its docking port and began making his way down the hamster tube. As he'd learned on his way here, this was going to take a while. The tube was barely large enough to accommodate a svelte human in a polyester coverall. A large man in a pressure suit banged and scraped the whole way. And yet it was easier to do it with the suit on than to drag the empty suit behind you or push it ahead of you, like a zero-G murderer trying to dispose of a body. In a few minutes, he was able to reach a node right along Izzy's central axis, where he had more space to move around, and there he began taking the suit off. This was not a full-fledged spacesuit, which, with its huge backpack life support system, would have been much too bulky for the hamster tube. It was just a helmeted coverall of the type worn by high-altitude pilots. It had a leak, and so was useful only as a costume. Escaping from it developed into a sort of wrestling match, with a lot of cursing and drifting around, banging into walls. At an opportune moment, he felt a sharp tug on the rear collar of the suit. This pulled it down to the point where he could shrug out of it and get his arms free.
"Thanks," he said,
and then looked over his shoulder to see a familiar face gazing at him quizzically. "Aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper?"
"Moira?"
Dube said. He grabbed a handle on the wall so that he could spin himself around and get a better look. His glasses had gone askew during the wrestling match, so he poked them back up on his nose. It was her, all right, suffering from a clear case of moonface. He had last seen Dr. Moira Crewe at the Crater Lake announcement, where she had been assisting her mentor, Clarence Crouch, the Nobel Prize-winning geneticist, the poor sod who had been given the job of explaining the casting of lots to the world. Since then, Clarence had died of cancer in his Cambridge home, surrounded by biological samples and scientific memorabilia that would not long survive the onset of the hard rain. No doubt it had been a blessing for him. Dube had lost track of Moira after that, but of all the people on Earth, she was one of the most obvious candidates for inclusion on the Cloud Ark. She was of West Indian ancestry, wearing her hair in finger-length dreadlocks that had adapted pretty well to zero gravity, better than white people hair, for sure. Moonface had added a few years to her apparent age, but Dube knew her to be in her late 20s. Raised in a dodgy part of London, she'd gone to a posh school on scholarship and went on to earn a biology degree at Oxford. She'd gone to Harvard for her PhD, working with a project there on de-extinction. Her general charisma and an accent that Americans found charming had made her into the most well-known spokesperson for that project. She had done TED Talks and other public appearances describing her lab's efforts to bring the woolly mammoth back to life. After a brief sojourn in Siberia, working with a Russian oil billionaire who wanted to create a nature preserve stocked with formerly extinct megafauna, she had returned to the UK and begun postdoctoral work with Clarence. It was not the first time Dube had been pleasantly surprised to bump into a colleague who had, unbeknownst to him, been sent up to Izzy. It always raised an awkward point of etiquette. It was tempting to express delight and give the person a big hug, as you'd naturally do if you encountered them at a party in Cambridge or on the street in New York City. But none of them had come up here on a happy errand. And Moira, anyway, had a certain owlish way about her, a way of keeping her distance. And hugging people in zero-G was harder than it sounded. You had to get to them first. Dube held his arms out to his sides.
"Hug,"
he said. She did the same. "Is that what one does here?" she asked.
"It is not unheard of. Moira, PCA, it is good to see you up here."
PCA was an abbreviation for Present Circumstances Aside, and had become a staple of Facebook, Twitter, and the like. "I had heard you'd come up," Moira said, "but it didn't quite register, as I've been awfully preoccupied."
"I can only imagine,"
Dube said.
while I've been running around shilling for the Cloud Ark. You've probably been doing actual science, huh?
Getting ready to do it might be more precise, she said. Her big brown eyes, behind a geeky but stylish pair of glasses, strayed in a direction. Is that what they call forward? She asked.
Yes.
Well, the place where I'm working is about as far forward as it's possible to get, because they want my lab to be sheltered by the big rock.
Amalthea?
Yes. And if we go there, I can show you a bit of what I've been up to. I feel I should offer you tea as well, but I don't know how to make it here. Jube smiled at her way of talking. She had been a fiend for theater at Oxford and might have become an actress. Intensely conscious of the difference between the way her people in London talked and the way people talked at her school and at Oxford, she'd become good at switching between those accents for effect.
I'd be happy to have a look,
he said.
I think I know the module you're talking about. I saw it docking a few days ago and was curious.
He hooked the unoccupied pressure suit to the wall of Moira's lab, and it hung there, an inanimate observer, as Moira showed him around. Never one for the life sciences, Dube couldn't understand everything she was saying to him, but he didn't care. Being able to relax and let someone else explain science to him was a welcome turnabout. Do you know about the black-footed ferret? She asked.
No, Dube said. I think you can pretty much assume that my answer to all questions about biology and genetics is going to be in the negative.
90% of their diet was prairie dogs. Farmers killed almost all of the prairie dogs, and so the population of black-footed ferrets crashed to the point where only 7 remained. From that breeding stock, it was necessary to bring them back.
Wow, only 7. So inbreeding must have been an issue.
We speak of heterozygosity, she said, which just means the amount of genetic diversity within a species. In general, it's a good thing. If you have too little of it, then you start to see the sorts of problems that we associate with inbreeding.
But if the breeding stock is reduced to only 7, then that's all you have to work with, right?
Not quite. Well, technically, yes, I suppose. But by manipulating some of the genes, we can create heterozygosity artificially, as well as getting rid of some of the genetic defects that would otherwise propagate through the whole population.
Anyway, Dube said, it's obviously of interest to us now.
If the Cloud Ark's as populous as they claim it's going to be, and if people come up with frozen sperm samples and ova and embryos and all of that, then the human population is probably all right. We'll have enough heterozygosity to make a go of it. My work here is going to be more concerned with non-human populations.
Meaning?
Well, you've probably heard that we'll be growing algae as a way to generate oxygen, which is only the start of a simple ecosystem that will have to be developed and grown and become much less simple over the years to come. Many of the plants and microorganisms that will make up that ecosystem will be cultivated from initially small breeding populations. We don't want to have a repeat of the Irish potato famine, or something analogous, with the plants we rely on to make it possible to breathe.
So your job will be to do with them what was done in the case of black-footed ferrets?
Part of my job, yes.
What's the other part?
Being a sort of Victorian museum curator. Did you ever visit Clarence's home in Cambridge?
No, I'm sorry to say. But I heard his collection was magnificent.
It was crammed with all of these stuffed birds and boxed beetles and mounted heads of beasts, gathered by Victorian gentlemen collector types in pith helmets, doing their bit for science on the fringes of the empire. Not scientists as we define them today, but contributors to the scientific ideal. These things overflowed the museums, and Clarence acquired them by the lorry load, especially after Edwina died and couldn't forbid it. Anyway, I'm that person now, except that the samples are all digital, and they are all on these things. She tapped a thumb drive that was floating around her neck on a chain. All their rad-hard equivalents. She pronounced the technical term with a dubious and ironic tone of voice, suggesting that she and the International Space Station would take a while getting used to each other. You know the general story. I've heard you talking about it on YouTube. She switched into a credible imitation of Dube's flat Midwestern vowels. We can't send blue whales and sequoias up on the cloud arc, and even if we could, we couldn't keep them alive there. But we can send their DNA, encoded as strings of ones and zeros.
You're going to put me out of a job,
Dube said. Good, then I'll put you to work here, Moira said. This is labor-intensive as hell. And they're not sending me enough help.
I thought it was all automatic.
If the agent had given us another couple of decades to improve our gene synthesis technology, it might have become so, Moira said. As it is, we've been caught in a bit of a gawky adolescent phase. Yes, we can take one of these files. She tapped the thumb drive around her neck. And we can create a strand of DNA from it, beginning with a few simple precursor chemicals. But the amount of human intervention is still ridiculous.
I'm guessing that is some pretty high-level human intervention, too.
My Jamaican grandfather worked in the engine room of a Navy ship, Moira said, which is how our family ended up in England. When I was a little girl, he took me on a tour of one of those ships, and we went down into the engine room, and I saw it. The engine, with all of the bits exposed. The bloody thing was naked, and men had to go crawling around on it with oil cans, lubricating the bearings by hand and so on. That's a bit like where we are now, with synthesizing whole genomes.
But for now,
Dube said,
that's far in the future, right?
Yes, thank God.
For now, you're going to be tinkering with intact organisms.
Yes, just so. Still quite difficult, but I think manageable. She looked around. The module in which they floated looked nothing like a lab. Everything was sealed up in plastic or aluminum cases, taped shut, and labeled with yellow sticky notes. Sorry, she said. Underwhelming. Hardly worth the trip, is it?
How can I help?
Get me some fucking gravity, Moira said. Then she laughed. Can you imagine trying to do tricks with liquids in zero-G? Because that's all a lab is.
It must look frustrating to you now,
Dube said.
Everything in boxes. No gravity to make it all work.
I know, she said. I'm whinging. They'll put this thing on a bolo, won't they?
Maybe a third torus. Big enough to make something close to Earth normal gravity. Lots of space to work in. A staff of eager arkers.
That's your job now, isn't it? Moira said. Cheerleader for the Ark.
It was my ticket up here,
Dube said. He could feel a little warmth creeping into his face and cautioned himself not to say anything he was going to regret.
We all needed that ticket. Now that we have paid the price of admission, we need to make it work.
Moira, perhaps sensing she'd gone a little too far, kept her silence and would not meet his gaze.
And as of today, he said, we have 1 year.
Part 2. Day 700. On day 700, also known as A plus 1.335, 1 year and 335 days since the destruction of the moon, the cloud arc, as seen from the Earth, looked like a bright bead strung on a silver chain. For the reasons that Dr. Dubois Jerome Xavier Harris had tried to articulate during his soliloquy aboard Arklet 2, back on A plus 1.0, it was expensive, in terms of propellant, to maintain an actual cloud or swarm of Arklets around Izzy. Much cheaper and more reliable was to have them precede or follow the space station along the same orbital path, like a queue of ducklings with Mom in the middle. Once an Arklet had found its place in that train, changing its position was a maneuver whose complications were a perennial source of surprise and consternation to newly arrived members of the so-called general population. Arkies as such, people who had been selected in the casting of lots, who had spent up to 2 years in training for this mission, and who had been sent up here specifically to manage and live in Arklets, understood it implicitly. As of day 700, there were 1,276 of those, with about 24 more coming up each day during the final surge of launches. New arrivals were assigned to empty Arklets that awaited them at the head or the tail of the queue. These were launched on separate heavy-lift rockets about 4 times a day. Since an Arklet consisted mostly of empty space, it weighed almost nothing compared to the lift capacity of a big rocket, and so they were always crammed from boiler room to front door with vitamins. These had to be extracted and stowed before the Arklet could be occupied. Each Arklet had its own unique manifest of stuff. Some of these were just full of compressed gas, such as nitrogen, which would later be used to fertilize crops. Others might be packed with enough diverse and seemingly random goods to open a space bazaar. Medicines, cultural artifacts, micronutrients, tools, integrated circuits, spare parts for Stirling engines, Arkie's personal effects, and, in one notable case, a stowaway who was found dead on arrival. With the exception of the stowaway, who was stashed in the morgue with the rest of the deceased, all of these items had to be extracted, catalogued, and stowed appropriately. Each Arklet had some onboard storage space, so to some extent, the storage was distributed, that being a fundamental tenet of the whole swarm-based architecture. Bulk materials like gases could be pumped into external tanks or bladders. Little ones dangling from Arklets, big ones distributed around Izzy's periphery where they could serve as extra shielding against radiation and micrometeoroids. So-called dry goods were likewise stashed in mesh bags that lived outside until such time as they were needed. Scarce and crowded inside space was reserved for organisms and goods that actually needed air and warmth. So, compared to the way it had looked a year ago, Izzy was spare and clean on the inside. Anyone who had not been chosen in the casting of lots and trained as an Arkie was categorized as general population. There were 172 of those. The number grew only slowly, since most of the people who were qualified and who were needed ought to have been sent up a long time ago. Adding new members was attended by much political controversy down on the Earth. The Crater Lake Accord had ratified the general scheme of a cloud ark populated by those chosen in the casting of lots. It had been obvious and uncontroversial that experienced specialists were also needed, and so no one had quibbled over sending up the scouts and the pioneers. The concept of the general population had been written into the Crater Lake Accord precisely to allow for that. People like Rhys Aitken, Louisa Soder, Dubois Harris, Moira Crewe and Marcus Luker had been sent up under the GPOP clause because they knew how to do things. For every one of them who got sent up, however, 100 with similar qualifications were stranded on the ground, where some of them called their congressmen, chancellors, presidents, or dictators. The politics had become so involved as to throttle the incoming flow to a trickle. The remaining available GPOP slots were being hoarded by national governments. They were being filled grudgingly and with Byzantine premeditation. For Arkies and members of the GPOP alike, it was easy to underestimate the distance separating Izzy from an Arklet that was only a few kilometers ahead of or behind it in orbit. The difficulties entailed in moving from one Arklet to another could be mitigated by physically docking Arklets to a common structure, forcing them to fly in a rigid formation, or so it might seem to people who had not been steeped in the laws of orbital mechanics. But the fact was that an Arklet docked to the end of a truss far off to the port or the starboard wing of Izzy was not in a proper orbit at all. Left to its own devices, free, that is, of the constraints imposed and the forces exerted by the truss, it would converge on Izzy, cross through Izzy's orbit, diverge from it, turn around, and converge again on the same 93-minute cycle that clocked Izzy's orbits around the Earth. An arclet mounted above Izzy on the zenith would want to go slower and lag behind. One mounted below on the nadir would want to race ahead. To the extent that the truss structure prevented those things from happening, to the extent, in other words, that it succeeded in its basic function of holding all the modules and arclets in a fixed configuration, it was undergoing stress, exerting forces on those arclets to prevent them from doing what they wanted to do. Humans in those arclets would notice themselves drifting and bumping into the walls as their natural trajectories, as ordained by Sir Isaac Newton, were perturbed by the structure of Izzy. The larger Izzy grew, and the more arclets and modules were connected to her, the greater those forces became, and the closer she came to breaking. There was another, even more compelling reason for limiting Izzy's sprawl. She was taking shelter behind Amalthea. The space station's original orbit had been carefully chosen. Any lower, and the thicker air would make the orbit decay too fast. Any higher, and the danger from micrometeoroids would increase. That was because the rocks zipping around in space were subject to the same slow orbital decay as Izzy herself, which was a good thing, since it dragged them down into the atmosphere and destroyed them, leaving clear space for Izzy to sail through. Her orbital altitude of 400 kilometers was a Goldilocks compromise between too much orbital decay for Izzy and enough orbital decay to sweep the sky of dangerous rocks. The attachment of Amalthea to Izzy's forward end a few years ago had changed all of that for the better. Orbital decay was less of a problem because of the rock's high ballistic coefficient, and micrometeoroids tended to get stopped by the massive nickel-iron cowcatcher. The white sky, however, was going to put many more rocks into their path. Big ones could be detected from a distance and avoided, but little ones could do a lot of damage, and so the most important parts of Izzy needed to take shelter in the lee of Amalthea, crowding up against her aft surface. Some rocks might still come in from unexpected directions, but in general there would be a prevailing wind in the drift of lunar debris. Amalthea was aimed into it. But Amalthea couldn't protect any parts of Izzy that projected beyond its silhouette. Dinah and the rest of the Arjuna expedition's crew had made some progress in embiggening the asteroid, carving out slabs of metal and then elevating them like flaps on an airplane wing to extend the sheltered envelope, but it could only get so big. At some point, it had been necessary to draw a line under the expansion and fix the envelope, meaning that Izzy took on a definite shape and size. This had occurred on A+1.233. Since then, they had found ways to jam more modules inside that envelope, or, where that wasn't possible, to pack bags and bladders of stored material into gaps. And they had tacked on additional storage in the unprotected volume outside of that envelope. But nothing had been added to her before or since. She couldn't grow in the aft direction because Amalthea's protective shadow only extended back so far. Bolides could wrap around in any direction, since they weren't in perfectly parallel trajectories. Anyway, boost engines were needed back there, and being in the path of rocket exhaust made standing in Hellfire seem like a pleasant summer's day by comparison. Amalthea was now enveloped in scaffolding, anchored directly into the nickel iron by connection points welded on or drilled in by Dinah's robots. A proboscis extended forward from that cloud of trusswork and supported a little cluster of radar and communication antennas. Forward of that, the closest arclets, seven of them docked to a hexagonal framework, kept station about a kilometer away, far enough that the firings of their thrusters would not blast those antennas with jets of hot gas. Other heptads, as the seven arclet clusters were called, were spaced ahead of that one at the same interval. Beyond a certain point, these petered out and were replaced by triads, three arclets on a triangular frame, and beyond that were singletons. A similar tapering could be observed aft of Izzy, though the distance to the first heptad was greater, respecting the danger posed by Izzy's boost engines. These heptads and triads were a bit like Lego or Tinker Toy parts, making it possible to cluster arclets together without much ado. Hamster tubes were laced through their trusses so that, once an arclet was docked, persons and material could be easily moved to other arclets on the same frame. Adapters were also floating around that would facilitate nose-to-nose coupling, but these had been found to be not as useful as the hep and tri frames. Farther out, towards the ends of the train, it was not uncommon to see bolos. Each of these spun with its center of gravity, the grapple joining the two cables, tracking along the shared orbital path of Izzy and the other arclets. For now, though, almost all such coupling was for training purposes. Only about 3 weeks remained before the white sky. The Arkies could survive that long in zero gravity. Formation of bolos and simulation of Earth-normal gravity was a practice intended for the long haul, when people might live their entire lives in arclets and would need gravity to build and preserve their bones, their eyesight, and other body parts that went bad in its absence. The cloud arc passed through a complete day-night cycle every 93 minutes. Time was arbitrary in space, and so the ISS had long ago settled on Greenwich time, also known as UTC, as a reasonable compromise between Houston and Baikonur. The cloud arc had inherited that system, and day 700 began at midnight at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, or A+1.335.0 in arc time. About one-third of the population woke up to begin a 16-hour shift. Others would wake up at A+1.335.8, or .8, and at .16. The system ensured that about two-thirds of the population was awake at any given time. Awake people needed more oxygen and generated more heat than sleeping people, so it put less of a strain on life support systems and enabled the cloud arc to support more people, if the waking and sleeping cycles were staggered. A reason for the popularity of triads was that each of the three component arclets could operate on a different shift, observing its own artificially imposed period of darkness and quiet. In a heptad, the same basic scheme could be used, with two of the arclets asleep at any given time, and the one in the middle of the hexagonal frame being always on. Doob had requested and been granted a position in the third shift, meaning that he was basically operating in the same time zone as Amelia, Henry, and Hadley on the west coast of the United States. He had awakened at .16 of the day before, or 4 in the afternoon in London, which was 8 in the morning in Pasadena. So, at the stroke of A+1.335.0, when the first shift of that day began, he had been awake for 8 hours and was feeling like a brief nap might do him good. But he knew that this would only make it more difficult to get to sleep at .8, and so decided, as usual, to gut it out. Finding that his brain was too addled to make any sense of the latest figures from Caltech on the continued exponential breakup of moon debris, he went to the gym, which was a module containing several treadmills. To prevent their users from bouncing off them in zero gravity, these were equipped with waist belts and bungee cords that held the occupants down, pressing their feet against the belt of the treadmill and forcing the legs to do some real work. Supposedly, it was good for the bones and muscles. Amelia kept sending Doob emails asking him whether he'd exercise today, and he liked to make her happy by answering yes. A few minutes after he began his exercise routine, he was joined by Louisa Soder, who had just awakened, as she was on the first shift. She liked to do her jogging first thing in the morning, so it was not the first time they had intersected in this way. Six treadmills had been mounted to the walls of this cylindrical module, the user's feet pointed outward, and their heads projected in toward the center, like spokes converging on a hub, bringing them rather close together and making conversation easy. For extroverted, social people like Dube and Louisa, this was a great setup. More solitary exercisers would don headphones and pointedly focus on a tablet or a book. "Did you go to Venezuela when you were out collecting Arkies?" Louisa asked him. The way she stressed the word "go" suggested that Venezuela was an obvious topic of conversation. The thing that well-informed persons would naturally begin talking about first thing in the morning. Dupe didn't know why. He had heard a few people talking recently about Kourou, which was the place in French Guiana where the Europeans, and sometimes the Russians, launched big rockets into orbit. In the last 2 years, it had become one of the most important launch sites for arklets and supply ships. So he had the vague sense that something was afoot there, something that people were concerned about. He had been focusing all of his attention in the other direction, on Peach Pit and its iron-rich children. These were still visible through increasingly thick clouds of rocky debris. When the white sky happened, they would vanish into a cloud of dirt, and he might not see them for a while. So he had been looking at PP1, PP2, and PP3 while the looking was still good, nailing down their exact orbital parameters, taking high-res photographs. PP3 was especially interesting. It was a congealed glob of mostly iron, similar in composition to Amalthea. It was some 50 kilometers in diameter, and it had a deep cleft on one side, comparable in size to the Grand Canyon, apparently formed by a collision that had rent its outer skin while it was partly congealed. Dube had begun calling PP3 cleft. "Dube, you still with me?" Louisa asked. "I was going to say Earth to Dube, Earth to Dube, but it doesn't apply anymore."
"Sorry,"
he said. He had gone into a reverie, thinking about the huge crevice on the side of cleft, imagining what it must look like from the inside.
"What was your question again?"
"Venezuela," she said. "Did you do any of your abduction runs there?"
"No," he said. "Closest I came was Uruguay, which isn't that close. And by that time I was pretty burned out."
"Why were you burned out?" Typical Louisa. "Overscheduling?" she went on. "That is, was it physical burnout, or more emotional, spiritual?"
"I had just had it," he said. "It's hard. Taking young people, the best and the brightest, away from their families."
"But it was for a good purpose, right?"
"Louisa, where are you going with this?"
"Are you aware of what is going on offshore of Kourou?" she asked in return.
"No,"
he said flatly. "You've checked out," she said.
"I talk to my family every day. But other than that, yes, Louisa, I have checked out of planet Earth. Nice place, lovely people, but I have to focus on what comes next."
"So say we all," she said. "But one could argue that things happening in old Earth's final 3 weeks could have repercussions on new Earth."
"What's going on?"
he asked. "Apparently, not a single one of the 75 Venezuelans who were picked in the casting of lots has actually been sent into space," she said.
"You know that the overall ratio has ended up being something like 1 in 20.
Dube said, meaning that for every 20 candidates chosen in the worldwide casting of lots and brought to the training centers, only one had found a place up here in the cloud arc. Not a figure to be proud of, but it was the best they'd been able to do. And they hoped to bring the number down to more like 1 in 15, or even 1 in 10, with a last-minute surge of launches. Yes, and the Venezuelans know that too. So they're saying that 3 or 4 of their 75 ought to have made it up here by now."
"Statistically, that is not a valid—"
"These people do not look like statisticians."
"Politics,"
Dube sighed. Louisa chuckled. "I hear you, sugar. I'm not going to say you're wrong. But I have to warn you that this is the word, politics, that nerds use whenever they feel impatient about the human realities of an organization."
"And I've been in enough faculty meetings at Caltech to know how right you are," Dube said. "But I meant it in a different way. The way that the Venezuelans ran their selection program was overtly political. In most countries, they took the casting of lots idea with a grain of salt. There was a random element, yes, but they also filtered for ability. The Venezuelans chose not to do that. So they ended up sending in kids from the boondocks, truly chosen at random, many of whom had fine personal qualities. If I had my way, we'd get some of them up here. But I'm not the one who is choosing. The people who are choosing on the basis of math ability and things like that. So it makes me sad that other people are in line ahead of the Venezuelans. But it doesn't surprise me.
3 weeks ago, boat people started squatting on Devil's Island, Louisa said, refusing to move.
Isn't that a penal colony?
Dube asked.
Why would anyone?
It used to be a French prison, yes, Louisa said. Hasn't been for a long time. Hardly anyone lives there. But it's right under the flight path for launches out of Kourou, so whenever there's a launch, they evacuate it.
It must be evacuated all the time, then, given the amount of traffic.
For the last 2 years, yes. But then a bunch of people showed up there and camped out and refused to move.
I'm guessing that the French and the Russians went right on launching.
In fact, Dube knew as much, since he saw arklets and supply ships coming up from Kourou all the time. Yes. So the occupation was more of a symbolic gesture at that point.
These squatters were Venezuelans, I take it.
Yes. It is a fairly easy cruise along the coast from Venezuela to French Guiana, a few hundred kilometers. Something was itching in Dube's memory.
Does this have anything to do with the supply vessel that failed to show up yesterday?
And the day before. There's been a 2-day interruption, going on 3, and launches out of Kourou.
A few squatters on Devil's Island can't explain that,
Dube said. Then he added as a joke.
Unless they have surface-to-air missiles.
Louisa said nothing.
Are you shitting me?
Dube said. It's not so much the ones on Devil's Island as the ones in the blockade, Louisa said. She handed her tablet to Dube. She'd pulled up what looked like an aerial photograph, probably shot out the window of a helicopter. In the foreground was the European Space Agency launch complex, which he'd seen before. It was separated from the Atlantic by a couple of kilometers of flat ground, banded with low, scrubby beach vegetation. In the distance was a trio of small islands, a few miles off the coast. He assumed that Devil's Island was one of them. The waters between the beach and the islands were choked with vessels, mostly small, but a few rusty freighters as well, a full-sized oil tanker that looked the worse for wear, and some ships that he could have sworn were military.
When was this taken?
Dube asked. A few hours ago, Louisa said.
Are those naval vessels?
The Venezuelan Navy is coming out to maintain order, Louisa said.
And you weren't kidding about the surface-to-air missiles.
The pirates who showed up in that oil tanker claimed that they had stingers and that they would use them against the next rocket that lifted off from Kourou.
That is nuts,
Dube said. Politics, Louisa said. But we always knew it was going to happen, right? Good morning, doctors, said a new voice. That of Ivy Shao, entering the module to begin her own morning exercise routine.
Good morning, doctor,
said Louisa and Dube in unison, though for Dube it was afternoon. Did I hear the P word? Yes, Louisa said. We were just talking about you, honey. Dube was appalled, but Ivy laughed delightedly. Ivy had been replaced, something like 8 months ago, by Marcus Luker, the Swiss fighter pilot, mountain climber, and astronaut. Or, to put it more precisely, a new position had been created that made Ivy's post redundant. Izzy was no longer just Izzy. It was the combination of the Cloud Arc fleet plus the vastly enlarged complex that Izzy had turned into. As such, A new leadership structure was required. The person at the top of that structure would shortly become the most powerful leader in human history, in the sense that 100% of all people alive would be under his or her authority. It was an altogether different job from being the first among the 12 equals who had been manning the International Space Station of 2 years ago. Nevertheless, Ivy could have done it. Everyone who really knew her agreed on that much. They had replaced her anyway. It was partly a matter of global politics. Placing overall command of the Cloud Ark under a representative of the United States, Russia, or China would have been seen as provocation by the two countries that had lost. So it had to be someone from a small country, preferably one that was seen as politically independent. This narrowed the list of candidates down to basically one, Marcus Luker. The dark horse being Ulrika Eck, the Swedish architect and project manager who had been launched up to Izzy at the same time as Marcus, but on a different vehicle in case one of them crashed. No one had ever really expected Ulrika to get picked, however. The choice was explained in terms of Marcus's dynamic leadership style, his charisma, and other such buzzwords that, as everyone understood, boiled down to the fact that he was a man. Ivy had failed, in the eyes of the Russians and of many in the NASA hierarchy, by not taking a firmer hand with Sean Probst. That wasn't the only complaint they had about her, but it was the one around which everything else had crystallized. Once everyone had begun to see her as the overly book-smart, well-meaning but weak-kneed technocrat, everything she did had been viewed through that lens. Dinah's rescue of Tekla had been examined under what doctors called the retrospectoscope, and been deemed a failure on Ivy's part to enforce necessary discipline. New arrivals to the Cloud Ark, prepped by internet comment threads and television pundits to see Ivy as a weak leader, began finding ways to make that into a self-fulfilling prophecy. The success of the Bolo 1 test, which in other circumstances might have bolstered her, came to be viewed as an almost literal handoff of authority from Ivy to Marcus. Presented with some choice opportunities to say supportive things about Ivy, Ulrika had declined to do so, and it wasn't clear whether that was mere absent-mindedness or an attempt to cement her position as number two. In any case, it was all squarely in the realm of politics. Dube had avoided bringing it up around Ivy, not wanting to raise an awkward topic, and so he found it horrifying when Louisa went straight to it, and fascinating when Ivy laughed. "People." "What is on your docket for today?" Louisa asked.
"Looking at spreadsheets," Ivy said, "trying to figure out the consequences of losing Kourou." "That is one monkey wrench we didn't need,"
Dube said.
"To be sure," Ivy said, "but in a weird way, I'm almost..."
And she trailed off. "Glad? Relieved?" Louisa guessed.
"It's like the starting gun finally went off," Ivy said. "We've been prepping for this for almost 2 years, awaiting the disaster, waiting for all hell to break loose. And now it has, just not in the way we expected."
"What were you expecting?" Louisa asked.
"That we'd get hit by a bolide and take a lot of casualties," Ivy said. "Instead, something unexpected happened, which is good training, in a way."
"How's your sweetie?" Louisa asked. Dube shut off his treadmill and unbuckled the padded belt that connected him to the bungee cords. He was the only man in a room where two women were talking about one of their boyfriends. He knew his cue to make himself scarce.
"He went dark on me 2 days ago," Ivy said, "which means he's probably underwater."
"I'm sure he'll pop up for air soon," Louisa said. "Can he send email when the submarine is submerged? I know nothing about it."
"There are ways," Ivy said,
but by that time Dube was floating out of the module. He made his way aft, down the stack to H2, then clambered down a spoke into the rotating torus T2, which Reese Aitken had been sent up to build. Gravity in it was 1/8 of Earth normal. Originally designed as a space hotel for tourists, It had never been quite up to the requirements placed on it by the Cloud Ark project, and so Rhys had been put in charge of building a larger one, concentric with T2, and inevitably called T3. Never one to rest on his laurels, he had invented a completely new system for building it. Unsurprisingly to Dinah, this had consisted of assembling a long loop of high-tech chain and setting it in motion around T2, then adding stuff onto it incrementally. It spun around the same hub at the same RPMs, but because it was bigger, its simulated gravity was a little stronger, about equal to that on the moon. It housed the closest thing the Cloud Ark had to a bridge. A segment of T3 about 10 meters long, used by Marcus as his headquarters. Attempts had been made to dignify it with names such as Command Center, but at the end of the day it was just an upgraded version of the banana, a conference room with some television screens and power feeds for tablet computers. Izzy didn't have a helm. It didn't have controls as such. No big wheel to turn for steering it through space. No throttle. Just a bewildering assortment of thrusters controlled through a web interface that could be pulled up on any tablet, provided you had the right password. So the control room, the bridge, the command center could be anywhere. People had ended up calling the room Marcus had chosen the tank. Adjoining it, on one side, was a smaller office that served as Marcus's sanctum sanctorum. Next to the tank, on the other side, was a larger room with a number of cubicles, bizarrely like a suburban office park, where people supporting Marcus could sit and work. It had been called the Cube Farm for about 10 minutes and was now simply called the Farm. Adjoining the farm on the other side was a maze of cramped rooms where one could obtain food or use the toilet. Doob had found that the farm was frequently the least crowded place on Izzy, just because it didn't occur to people to go there. The gravity was good for his bones, and the availability of coffee and toilets were obvious pluses. So he tended to swing by a couple of times a day, get a beverage, see what was happening, and if things were quiet, grab a vacant Carol and do some work. He got there at about .2. The walls of the farm, and of the adjoining tank, were lined with projection screens, known in NASA speak as situational awareness monitors. They acted as windows onto various parts of the Cloud Ark and its environs. One was showing the Earth below them. Another, the cloud of debris that had been the moon. Another, the approach of a supply module from Cape Canaveral, getting ready to dock. Another, the progress of a bolo coupling drill being conducted by some newly arrived Arkies several kilometers aft. Some just displayed statistics and bar charts. The biggest, at the far end of the farm, was occupied mostly by a grainy video feed from some part of the Earth where it was dark. A label, superimposed at the bottom, identified it as Kourou, French Guiana. Once Jube had that information to work with, he could make out the general scene. A galaxy of lights from the thousands of boats that had joined the People's Justice Blockade. And in the background, the much more orderly precincts of the spaceport, where an Ariane stood on one pad and a Soyuz on the other, ready to launch, but still unable to do so because of the threat of those stingers. The silhouette of a military chopper passed between the camera and the lights of the launch complex. This was a 24-hour news network. The crawl, running across the bottom of the screen, was being updated every few minutes by the current BFR, or bolide fragmentation rate, which had started out at zero on A+0, and been climbing ever since then. This was the number that, when it caromed through the bend in its exponential curve, would signal the onset of the white sky. The networks had been tracking it obsessively. There was an app for it. A bar in Boston had begun offering end-of-the-world drink specials whenever the BFR broke through certain milestones, and the promotion had been copied widely. Above the crawl was a smaller video inset showing an empty lectern in the White House briefing room. Apparently, they were expecting some sort of announcement. Doob sat in one of the carrels, spent a few minutes checking email, and then tried to get back to his main task, which was to write a memo about the distribution of metal-rich moon fragments, how they might be reached and exploited, and why that should be interesting to the management of the Cloud Ark. It was only a few sentences in, however, when movement on the big situational awareness monitor caught his eye, and he looked up into the eyes of the President of the United States. She was staring into the camera, or rather the teleprompter screen in front of the camera, and delivering some sort of terse announcement. She looked pissed off. Pinned to her lapel was a loop of ribbon. All the important people had been wearing these for the last few weeks, and they had become popular among the hoi polloi as a gesture of solidarity with the mission of the Cloud Ark. Selecting the color scheme had consumed resources equivalent to the gross domestic product of a medium-sized country. They had settled on a thin red line down the center, symbolizing the bloodline of the human race, flanked by bands of white, symbolizing starlight, flanked by bands of green, symbolizing the ecosystem that would keep the Arkies alive, flanked by bands of blue, symbolizing water, and finally, edged by bands of black, symbolizing space. The discussion had been as lively as the results were complicated. Black symbolized death to Westerners, white symbolized it to Chinese, and so on. This design offended everybody. It had gotten loose on the internet as the official ribbon design, even though the commission charged with designing it had become hopelessly deadlocked and was still evaluating 12 different candidate designs submitted by schoolchildren from around the globe. Factories in Bangladesh had been repurposed to hurl this stuff out by the linear kilometer, and they had shown up in kiosks and souvenir shops from Times Square to Tiananmen Square. And the world's leaders had bowed to the verdict and begun wearing them. The president had attached hers using a lapel pin consisting of a simple disc of turquoise rimmed in platinum. The blue disc on the white field was meant to echo Crater Lake amid the snows of November. It was a visual emblem of the Crater Lake Accord, and the closest thing that the Cloud Ark had to a flag. The sound had been turned down, so Dube couldn't hear what JBF was saying, but he could guess it well enough. And a few seconds later, the highlights began to show up in the crawl at the bottom of the screen. The so-called People's Justice Blockade was no grassroots movement, but an operation planned and carried out by the Venezuelan government. It was a reprehensible political stunt that was actively interfering with the all-important building of the Cloud Ark. It was not true, as some had been whispering, and the Venezuelan president was now openly saying, that the white sky was a hoax. The blockade was not, as its sympathizers would have you believe, a peaceful civil disobedience protest. Armed intruders had begun landing on the beaches of French Guiana a few hours ago and were now being held at bay by the French Foreign Legion, bolstered by a multinational force including United States and Russian Marines. Dube, doing his best to tune it out, couldn't defeat the irrational feeling that JBF was staring directly at him, a feeling he had come up here partly to get away from. One of the PR flacks down in Houston reached him over a video chat link that Dube had not had the presence of mind to disable. He talked Dube into spending the next hour writing a little homily about how everyone down on Earth needed to unite behind the all-important mission of the Cloud Ark, and detailing how the Kourou blockade was affecting that. Dube wanted, in the worst way, to tell this guy to get lost. But he had a soft spot for people who only had 3 weeks to live. Dube called Ivy, for Izzy had its own cell phone system now, and got her to supply a few hard, quotable numbers, which he rounded off and typed into his script. He then devoted a minute to psyching himself up to adopt the Doc Dubois persona. Formerly the ruin of his first marriage, the basis of his livelihood, and his ticket to the Cloud Ark, Doc Dubois was a person he rarely had to be anymore. That guy seemed as dated as a character from a 1970s television serial. Getting into the persona was nearly as cumbersome as donning a spacesuit. It required an extra cup of coffee with sugar. When he felt he was ready, he turned on his tablet's video camera, identified himself as Doc Dubois, greeted the people of Earth, and read his little script. When he was finished, he emailed the file down to Houston. Then he tried to go back to his memo, but he became distracted when the situational awareness monitor flashed up a red breaking news banner and began to show footage of indistinct flashes against a dark background. Some sort of hostilities had broken out on the ground in French Guiana, between the perimeter of the spaceport and the beach. The French Foreign Legion was participating in what might be the last battle ever fought. But the television news cameras couldn't get anywhere near the action, so the coverage mostly consisted of journalists interviewing each other about how little they knew. In the middle of all that, the FLAC in Houston got back to him and asked if he could please relocate to a part of Izzy where zero gravity prevailed and re-record the little pep talk. Conspiracy theorists were saying that the Cloud Ark didn't really exist and that it was actually just a bunch of movie sets in the Nevada desert. Whenever they saw video from parts of the space station with simulated gravity, they cited it as evidence and added millions of friends and followers to their social media profiles. Dube said he'd see what he could do, and departed from the farm. Nothing was going on here anyway. Marcus wasn't around at the moment. He ascended a spoke to H2 and thus entered zero gravity. H2 had been the aftmost piece of the stack, the train of modules that ran up Izzy's central axis, until several weeks ago when the caboose had been launched up from Kourou and mated to its aft end. The main purpose of the caboose was to house a large rocket engine, burning hydrogen and oxygen, which would do most of the work of boosting Izzy's orbit. It wasn't possible to extend Izzy any farther back because, beyond that point, anything tacked onto it would no longer reside safely within Amalthea's protective envelope. And indeed, there had been long discussions of contingency plans for the case where the caboose took a hit and its engine was destroyed. Putting his back to the caboose, Dube began to drift forward up the stack. H2 led to H1, which led in turn to the old Zvezda module. This had formerly sported small photovoltaic panels to its port and starboard sides, but these, like most of Izzy's solar panels, had been folded up and removed to make space for other construction. During an intermediate stage of the architect's labors, power had come not from photovoltaics, but from little nukes, the same as those on the arklets. These still protruded from attachment points all over the space station, aglow with red LEDs meant as a warning to spacewalkers and pilots, and they still produced a significant amount of power and served as a valuable backup. But most of the station's power now came from a full-fledged nuclear reactor, adapted from those used on submarines, which was mounted on a long stick that projected to nadir from the caboose. There were a number of reasons why a big power plant might be needed, but the most important of these was to produce rocket propellant by splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen. And this explained why the reactor was where it was. The caboose housed the big boost engine that was Izzy's largest consumer of propellant. And it was also the central nexus of the shipyard complex, where smaller vehicles could be assembled from a kit of parts. Once assembled, they too would need propellant. Zvezda's forward terminus was a docking station with ports to the Zenith and Nadir sides, where scientific laboratories had been connected back before Zero. This tradition had been preserved, in a way, by turning that docking site into Grand Central Station for work related to the Cloud Ark's primary function of preserving the Earth's heritage. If Dube went up in the zenith direction, he entered a long module whose main purpose was to support multiple docking ports where other vessels could be and had been attached. In general, these were crammed with priceless cultural relics, but some of them also supported server farms where digital recordings were stored. Certain relics were easier than others to send into space. The Magna Carta had made it up here, but Michelangelo's David was still on the ground. Considerable effort had gone into sealing up heavy relics in everything-proof vaults and leaving them on the bottom of the oceans or in deep mine shafts. But Dube had long since lost track of the progress of that undertaking. If instead Jupe went down in the nadir direction, he entered a similar three-dimensional maze of modules. Most of these were devoted to storage of genetic material, seeds, sperm samples, eggs, and embryos. All of these needed to be kept cold, which in space wasn't too difficult. It was primarily a matter of shielding the storage containers from sunlight, which could be done with a featherweight piece of metallized mylar film, and secondarily a matter of just preventing the warmth of surrounding objects from seeping into the samples. Dube always paused when passing by that hatch. He was not a spiritual man, but he could not humanly ignore the fact that his potential fourth child, the embryo he and Amelia had created, was in there somewhere, along with tens of thousands of other fertilized embryos waiting to be thawed out and implanted in human wombs. He passed into Zarya, which was the next module forward in the stack. Having been mildly spooked by thinking about embryos, he now had a vague intention of going into the woo-woo pod to re-record his video. This was a spherical inflated structure, 10 meters in diameter, with several large domed windows. It was accessed from Zarya via a hamster tube on the nadir side, so it was aimed at the Earth. Ulrika Eck had drawn the ire of every religious group on the planet by refusing to provide separate places of worship for every single one of them in the Cloud Ark. Instead of sending up a church pod, a synagogue pod, a mosque pod, etc., she had provided this one structure, which was something like the interfaith chapel at an airport, in that all of the different religions had to share it. Internal projectors would display crosses, Stars of David, or what have you, on its interior surfaces, depending on what sort of services were happening there at the moment. It had a long, cumbersome, politically correct name, but someone had dubbed it the Woo-Woo Pod, and the name had stuck. That someone paused for a few moments at the entrance to the hamster tube that led to it and detected the haunting tonalities of the Muslim call to prayer. Too bad. He'd thought that the pod might actually be a good backdrop for the message he was meant to deliver, but he would have to find another place. Directly across, a hatch led into the rambling group of modules that served as Izzy's sickbay. This had consumed much of the space formerly used by the portside solar panels. At its farthest extremity, blocked off by an insulated hatch, was the surplus module that had been used as Izzy's morgue and graveyard since the first scout launch on A plus 0.29, when two of the cosmonauts had been found dead on arrival. The terrific mortality rate of those first few weeks had half filled this thing with freeze-dried bodies. Since then, 14 more had died of various causes. One, of a subarachnoid hemorrhage that could just as well have happened on the ground. One of a heart attack, two of suicide, two of equipment failure, four, just a few days ago, in the sudden depressurization of an arclet struck by a bolide. Those, plus the dead stowaway, were all stored in the morgue. The whereabouts of the other four fatalities could only be guessed at. One was a spacewalker who had simply disappeared. The remaining three had been sleeping in a Xinjiao spacecraft docked to the end of a hamster tube, which had been struck by a bolide the size of a coffee table and essentially vaporized. Performing his video surrounded by free-floating, freeze-dried corpses would shut up the truthers, but otherwise had nothing to recommend it. On the opposite wing, where the starboard solar panels had once operated, was a roughly symmetrical arrangement of modules used by the general population for miscellaneous living and working purposes. These connected to the stack mostly by way of the old American modules, Unity, Destiny, and Harmony. Consequently, there tended to be a lot of humans flying around in those modules, getting from one part of the space station to another, or clustering for the equivalent of water cooler chats. Beyond Harmony was Node X. NASA liked to give these things names by organizing contests for schoolchildren, which was how Harmony had ended up being called that. but the Node-X naming project had been defunded before achieving a result, so Node-X it was. It had never really found a purpose, so it had become the place where the life sciences gear was stored, or rather, the central connector to which the life sciences modules had docked one by one as they had been sent up. This part of the stack was very close to Amalthea, and accordingly well protected, and so it was a good place to store that irreplaceable equipment during the wait for it to become useful. Dube poked his head into several of those modules, hoping to encounter Moira, then remembered that, London girl that she was on third shift, not due to wake up for another 3 hours. It was about .5, pre-dawn in London. Beyond Node-X was the considerably larger Scrum, which was literally bolted onto Amalthea at its forward end. So it was the forwardmost thing in the stack. Before Zero, it had been nearly deserted. Since then, it had grown and developed into the space-based headquarters of Arjuna Expeditions. People called it the Mining Colony. They had plugged in more modules until all of its ports were occupied, and then they had begun to attach scaffolding and additional modules, rigid and inflatable, directly to the aft surface of Amalthea. It was around now that Dube forgot entirely about the task that the Flak and Houston had assigned him, and decided to hang out here for a little while and see what was going on. By all rights, this ought to have been his favorite part of the Cloud Ark. Yet he never visited, because coming here put him in mind of politics, which stressed him out and distracted him. His earlier conversation with Louisa had brought home to him, however, that ignoring politics might not be the wisest long-term strategy. He might not care about politics, but politics cared about him. And besides, the people who actually worked here, people like Dinah, were terrific. He had no problem with them personally. He should spend more time with them. Right now, he was 3 hours short of the end of his waking cycle. This was the rough equivalent of mid-evening. Time to kick back and grab a beer. No better people to do that with than miners. The mining colony was political for two reasons. First of all, and most obviously, it had originated from a public-private partnership of which the private half was Arjuna Expeditions, Sean Probst's company, which had all been well and good until he had burst into H2, raised hackles, and ruffled feathers all over the place. Secondly, but much more murkily, there seemed to exist some fundamental disagreement about what the Cloud Ark was supposed to be and how it was expected to develop in the years following the White Sky. Was it going to stay in place, i.e., remain in the same basic orbit? Transition to some other orbit? Would it stay together as a compact swarm or spread out? Or would it split up into two or more distinct swarms that would try different things? Arguments could be made for all of the above scenarios and many more, depending on what actually happened in the hard rain. Since the Earth had never before been bombarded by a vast barrage of lunar fragments, there was no way to predict what it was going to be like. Statistical models had been occupying much of Dube's time because they had a big influence on which scenarios might be most worth preparing for. To take a simplistic example, if the moon could be relied on to disassemble itself into pea-sized rocks, then the best strategy was to remain in place and not worry too much about maneuvering. It was hard to detect a pea-sized bolide until it was pretty close, by which time it was probably too late to take evasive action. A strike from a rock that size would perforate an arclet or a module of Izzy, but not destroy it. People might get hurt and stuff might get broken, but the worst case was that a whole module or arclet would be destroyed with the loss of a few lives. On the other hand, in the more likely scenario, where the hard rain included rocks the size of cars, houses, and mountains, detection from a distance would be easier. Evasive action would be not only feasible, but obligatory. Or at least, it was obligatory for Izzy. For a single arclet, it didn't matter whether it got struck by a rock the size of a baseball or one the size of a stadium. It was equally dead in either case. Izzy, on the other hand, could survive the first of these with the loss of a few modules, but the second would obliterate the whole space station and probably lead to the slow death of the entire cloud arc. Izzy had to be capable of maneuvering out of a large bolide's path. Maneuvering conjured images, in non-technical minds, of football players weaving among their opponents in an open field. What the architects had in mind was considerably more sedate. Izzy would never be agile. Even if she were, maneuvering in that sense would waste a lot of fuel. If an incoming rock big enough to destroy her were detected long enough in advance, she could get out of its path with a thruster burn so deft that most of her population would not even know it had happened. So, the optimistic view of how this was going to work was that Izzy would remain in something close to her current orbit, with occasional taps on the thrusters that would move her out of the way of any dangerous bolides hours or days in advance of the projected collision. The analogy was made to an ocean liner gliding through a field of icebergs, avoiding them with course changes so subtle that the passengers in the dining room wouldn't even see the wine shifting in their crystal stemware. There was, inevitably, a more pessimistic vision in which Izzy was more like an ox blundering across an 8-lane highway in heavy traffic. Depending on who was making the analogy, the ox might or might not be blindfolded and or crippled. Which of these analogies was closer to the truth boiled down to a statistical argument in which were braided together assumptions about the range and distribution of bolide sizes, the amount of variation in their trajectories, how well the long-range radars worked, and how good the algorithms were at sorting out all the different bogeys and deciding which ones were dangerous. Somewhere in the middle, between the ocean liner and the blind ox, was the football player pushing the wheelbarrow. It didn't matter whether football for you was soccer or the American sport played by men in helmets. In either case, you were meant to envision a player trying to weave a path downfield among defenders. A skilled player could succeed at this when running unencumbered, but would fail if obliged to push a wheelbarrow with a boulder in it. The boulder, of course, was Amalthea. And the wheelbarrow was the asteroid mining complex that had been constructed around it. If this analogy were the one closest to the truth, then the wheelbarrow would have to be abandoned. The image was sufficiently clear and sufficiently alarming that some had begun to argue for ditching Amalthea as far back as day 30. More level-headed analysts pointed out that if the ocean liner analogy applied, there was no need to take such drastic action. And if Izzy were a blind, crippled ox on a freeway, there was no point anyway. Dube had his own bias, a bias frankly rooted in a certain frozen embryo, which was that the mining colony should be preserved at all costs. When he tried to filter out that bias and to look at the models and the data in a completely objective way, he concluded that the jury was still out. So technical discussions of the matter tended to be unproductive, except insofar as they revealed the biases that the participants had brought into the room with them. And here was where it started to get difficult for him personally, because he couldn't understand why anyone would harbor a bias different from his own. Why would anyone not want to keep the mining colony? What were they thinking? How could the Cloud Arc and the human race have a future without those tools and capabilities? In any case, the controversy had ramifications that extended into many seemingly mundane aspects of the Cloud Arc program. If Izzy was going to maneuver with Amalthea attached to it, then the structure holding the rock to the space station needed to be strong. To put it another way, the stronger it was, the more heroic maneuvers could be achieved without breaking it. The ability to perform such maneuvers made the survival of Izzy more likely, and so requests for additional structural work had a kind of self-justifying force. Conversely, a weaker structure limited maneuvering ability and increased the odds that they would have to jettison the mining colony in order to survive. And why dump scarce resources into beefing up a subassembly that was going to be abandoned anyway? A similar dynamic obtained in the case of propellant. More of it was needed to maneuver an Izzy with a big rock on it, which meant less of it for the Arklets, limiting their autonomy and operating range. Thus, physics drove politics to the extremes of ditch the rock now or keep the rock at all costs. The mining colony now comprised 8 modules, plus an inflatable dome that was attached directly to the asteroid. The robots had spent several weeks welding a 3-meter diameter ring onto a circular groove that they had prepared on Amalthea's surface. The inflatable had been mated to it about 100 days ago and filled with breathable atmosphere. It was not quite a shirt-sleeves environment, since the asteroid was cold and chilled the air in the dome, and many of the robot's normal operations produced gases that were toxic, or at least irritating. But that wasn't the point of having a dome. The point was to recapture and reuse the gases used by the robot's plasma torches, making it possible to excavate and reshape the asteroid much faster than had been possible in the early days, when all of those gases had leaked away into space. Since then, Dinah's complement of robots had been heavily reinforced by newer and better versions of the same basic models that had been shipped up from Earth. And Dinah herself was now managing a crew of 12, working in shifts around the clock. They'd been expanding the tunnel she had carved into the asteroid long ago to protect her circuit boards from cosmic rays, making slow progress on hollowing out the asteroid, carrying bits of metal away to a bigger and better smelter that was turning them into steel. Since there was no real place for it in Izzy's master plan, they'd been putting that steel to work in reinforcing Amalthea's structural connection to Izzy, feeding back into the political argument again. Doob glided through a few of the mining colony's modules, asking people where Dinah was, and got noncommittal answers. When he made a move in the direction of her shop, he sensed an uptick in nervous tension and did not understand why until Marcus Luker emerged, greeted him personally, and engaged him in friendly, inconsequential chit-chat. Stalling for time, as Doob understood, so that Dinah could have a few minutes to herself. It had been known for several months that Dinah had been having sex with Marcus, an activity referred to on Izzy as climbing the Daubenhorn. 2 other women were known to have attained that summit not long after Marcus's arrival, but since then Dinah had had him all to herself. By the standards of earthbound organizations, be they corporate or military, it was an eyebrow-raising violation of ethical standards for the boss to be sleeping with a subordinate. But a month from now, every living human would technically be one of Marcus's subordinates. So he either had to break the rules or be celibate for the rest of his life. No one who knew him very well saw the latter as a realistic option, unless he were to have his testicles surgically removed, a procedure that certain people on Izzy were longing to see performed. That being the case, there was a certain logic in his having settled quite early on Dinah. It might be unethical, but at least everyone knew where matters stood. Dinah was no one's idea of a pushover. No sane person could be worried that she was in any way feeling pressured or harassed. And on the other side of that coin, people seemed to feel more comfortable knowing that Dinah was not on the prowl. By the mundane standards of Izzy gossip, her dalliance with Rhys Aitken had been sensational. Their eventual breakup, a big story, detailed in London tabloids. After that, she'd been unable to have coffee with any male crew member without stirring up more whispers. Being unequivocally in the bag with Marcus was a lot simpler. And yet it still had to be treated as if it weren't happening, which was why Marcus and Doob had to take part in this charade.
"I don't know if you heard,"
Doob told him,
"but fighting has broken out on the ground, between the spaceport and the beach."
It was clear that Marcus hadn't heard, which was hardly surprising given that A, it wasn't his problem, and B, he'd been occupied. He was, understandably, quite relaxed at the moment, and it took a while for him to bring his formidable powers of concentration to bear on the matter at hand.
"I can't believe they will let it go on like that," he said.
The president made a statement. She looked like she was eating bolts.
"A government run by doomed persons is nothing to trifle with," Marcus said. "But I suppose the same could be said of the Venezuelans." He sighed. "I wonder if we should just accommodate some Venezuelan archies. There must be a few bright sparks."
"That would have worked a couple days ago," Dube said. "But now it's turned into one of those we-don't-negotiate-with-terrorists things."
A trace of a dry smile came over Marcus's lips. He had washed his face with the towelettes they all used. Dube could smell the industrial fragrance with which they were permeated.
"Of course," he said. "It wouldn't do to set a precedent that might be abused during the next 3 weeks."
The joke, such as it was, would have been completely unacceptable when uttered in public, or even in a meeting, so this was a way of saying to Dube, "You are in my confidence." Dube wasn't a leader, but he was fascinated by people who were, and how they went about their work.
"Ivy's figuring out the ramifications of not having those arklets. Those supplies."
"Thank God for Ivy," Marcus said.
Since winning command of the Cloud Ark, he had never lost an opportunity to praise her, another skill that Dube reckoned must be inculcated into leaders in whatever mysterious leader academy churned them out. More likely it was an instinct.
"Well, my day begins," Marcus continued. "Thank you for the briefing."
Marcus, like a lot of the Europeans, ran on third shift, which meant that he was, in fact, beginning his day a couple of hours early.
"Mine is winding down,"
Dube said.
"I thought I would get drunk with some miners."
"No better people for it," Marcus said with a wink. "I believe Dinah will be out in a minute. I think she would enjoy seeing you."
With that, Marcus pulled his phone from the pocket of his coverall and turned his attention to its screen while using the other hand to pull himself out of this module and down the stack. Dube was left floating in the middle of the scrum. The only thing between him and Dinah was a privacy curtain. He was about to say, "Knock, knock," when he heard a string of beeps emerge from a speaker on the other side. An incoming Morse code transmission, which he had not the skill to understand. To that point, Dinah had been quiescent, but he now heard her going into movement, peeling herself out of her sleeping bag. He thought better of bothering her just now, and decided to check his own email. She ran on first shift, which meant that this was mid-afternoon for her, traditionally a time when she began to feel a little drowsy, even when Marcus had not just been helping her relax. She felt that going fully to sleep would be a bad idea, partly because she had work to do, and partly because it would lead to more gossip than was happening already. She could hear Marcus chit-chatting with Dubois Harris on the other side of the curtain. She knew that he was stalling for her, giving her some time to pull herself together. She was duly appreciative, and she made the most of it, gliding in the liminal zone between dozing and waking until her radio began to beep. She knew immediately that this was not Rufus. She could tell as much by the fist of the transmission. It was faint, and it was clearly not the work of an experienced ham. Her eyes opened as a thought came to her. Maybe this was the source known as the space troll. That term had originated with Rufus, who had first mentioned it several days ago. "Have you heard from the space troll yet?" It was his name for a transmitter that he had begun picking up recently, and it matched what Dinah was hearing now. She ejected herself from the bag, turned up the volume on the receiver, and listened while pulling on a T-shirt and some drawstring pants. The signal sounded as if it was coming in from a homebrew transmitter. The owner had a sketchy understanding of the practices and etiquette of the CW, Morse code using, radio world. His dots and dashes were perfectly formed and came rapidly, as much as proving that he was using a computer keyboard and an app that automatically converted keystrokes into Morse. He was sending out a lot of QRKs and QRNs, which were queries about the strength of his own signal and the degree to which it was being interfered with. So he seemed a little insecure about the quality of his equipment. According to Rufus, as soon as you started transmitting back to the space troll, he would shoot back a spate of QRSs, meaning, please transmit more slowly. Further proof that he was a novice using a computer keyboard to form the groups, but not very good at deciphering what came back. He transmitted on one frequency only, which was the one that Rufus had, until a year ago, generally used to contact Dinah. This had become known to the Internet in the wake of a human interest story about the Macquarie family, and so for a few weeks, it had been damned near unusable as every CW ham on the planet had tried to use it to contact Dinah. Then the word had gotten around that the Macquaries, Père et Fils, weren't using it anymore, and it had gone pretty silent. Except for a few people who apparently hadn't gotten the memo, such as the space troll. Anyway, Rufus had gone back to monitoring that frequency again, and Dinah was now doing likewise. She had not personally heard any transmissions from the space troll. This was not remarkable. Her antenna was nothing compared to the one that Rufus had installed above his mine, and her receiver was something out of a fifth-grade science project. Except when Izzy was passing over his meridian, she and Rufus would naturally hear different stations. According to Rufus, having a conversation with the space troll required patience or a sense of humor. The fact that novice hams were screwing around on the radio, which would have driven Rufus into a spasm of righteous fury a few years ago, now just seemed like a sign of the times. Of course people were getting interested in amateur radio. The Internet was expected to go down as soon as the hard rain started. And of course, many of them were novices. When they finally did begin an intelligible conversation, Rufus would send QTH, which meant, "Where are you?" and would get back QET. This was an unofficial Q code, a sort of corny joke meaning, "Not on planet Earth." And that was why Rufus called this guy the space troll, because, among other oddities, he didn't have a call sign, or at least didn't use one. The signal she was hearing now was QRA QET, repeated every few seconds. It meant basically, "Hello, this is ET. Is anyone listening?" Dinah generally kept the transmit side of her rig turned off when not in use. She turned it on now, but kept her hand well clear of the brass telegraph key. Lurking and listening were harmless, but as soon as she touched that thing, the space troll would hear an answering beep, and then she might never be rid of him. More likely, though, was that the space troll would give up after a while. Then she could transmit to Rufus, who'd be coming up over the horizon in a few minutes, and let him know that she, too, had heard from the mysterious extraterrestrial. It would be good for a laugh and a few minutes' distraction. Her father sounded like he could use some of both. It had long since become obvious that he and a number of his mining industry friends had mounted a serious operation to prepare for an extended stay beneath the surface of the Earth. They were hardly the only ones to think that way. People were digging holes in the ground all over the world. Most of them would be dead within hours or days of the beginning of the hard rain. Constructing an underground complex that could sustain itself for thousands of years was an operation of which few, if any, organizations were capable. Most of those were governmental or military. But if any private group could do it, it was Rufus and his network. The sorts of questions he had been asking her for the last 2 years left nothing to the imagination. To the extent that the experts on Izzy knew anything about long-term sustainability of artificial ecosystems, Rufus now knew it too. Distracted by thinking about Rufus and his mine, Dinah became aware that the space troll's transmission had changed. Instead of the familiar QRA-QET, it now began with QSO, which in this context meant, "Can you communicate with?" This was followed by an unfamiliar call sign, which she didn't recognize as such because it was so long. A string of digits and letters that didn't follow any of the standard conventions for radio call signs. The third time this transmission was repeated, she wrote it down, 12 characters in all, a basically random assortment of digits and letters. But she did notice that all the letters were in the range A through F, which was a strong hint that this was a number expressed in hexadecimal notation, a system typically used by computer programmers. The fact that it had 12 digits was also a clue. The network chips used by almost all computer systems had unique addresses in that format, 12 hexadecimal digits. And here was where Dinah got a weird feeling on the back of her neck, because the first few digits in that string looked familiar to her. Network interface chips were produced in large batches, with unique addresses assigned to each chip in sequence. So, just as all Fords rolling off the assembly line in a given week might have serial numbers beginning with the same few characters, all the network chips in a given batch would start with the same few hex digits. Some of Dinah's chips were cheap, off-the-shelf hardware made for terrestrial use. But she also had some rad hard ones, which she hoarded in a shielded box in a drawer beneath her workstation. She opened that drawer, pulled out that box, and took out a little green PC board, about the size of a stick of gum, with an assortment of chips mounted to it. Printed in white capital letters directly on the board was its MAC address. And its first half-dozen digits matched those in the transmission coming from the space troll. She reached for the key encoded in QSO, meaning in this context, yes, I can communicate with, and then keyed in the full MAC address of the little board in her hand, different from the one in the original transmission. It was a way of saying, no, I can't communicate with the one you mentioned, but I can communicate with this other one. QSB came the answer back. Your signals are fading. Then QTX46, which she guessed meant something like, will you be available on this frequency 46 minutes from now? As anyone on Izzy would understand, this meant, I will call you back when you have orbited around to the other side of the planet. QTX-46, she answered back. Yes. They were passing over the Terminator, currently dividing the Pacific into a day side and a night side.
Who the hell are you talking to?
This was a transmission from Rufus, loud and clear. She looked out the window to see the west coast of North America creeping over the horizon toward them, identifiable as a pattern of lights delineating the conurbations of the Fraser Delta, Puget Sound, the Columbia River, San Francisco Bay, which meant that Alaska had line of sight to Izzy.
Knock, knock,
came the voice of Dubois Harris through the curtain. He'd been waiting there for a long time. Come in, Dinah said, and keyed back a brief transmission to Rufus, making a joke about the space troll and telling him she would be in touch later. She checked the world clock app on her computer screen. It was shortly before .7, therefore 7 a.m. in London, therefore 10 in the evening for Rufus in Alaska. A somewhat distracted and scattered conversation followed. Dinah, trying to maintain a train of thought with Dub, while fielding sporadic, peremptory interruptions from Rufus. Something kind of weird just happened on the radio, she said. Do you want a drink? It's evening for you, right?
I pretty much always want one, Dub said. Let's not worry about it. What's up?
Dinah related the story. Dub looked distracted at first, perhaps because of all the ham radio jargon, but focused when she showed him the MAC addresses.
The simplest explanation, he pointed out, is that it's a troll, just messing with you.
But how would a troll know about those MAC addresses? We don't give those out. We don't want our robots getting hacked from the ground.
The PR people have come through here, haven't they? Taking pictures of you and your robot lab? Mightn't it be the case that a picture got snapped when you had that box open, and some of those PC boards visible?
There's no gravity in here, Dub. I can't leave things lying around on my desk.
Because Dube said. Obviously, what's going on here is that someone wants to talk to you through a private channel.
And they are proving their identity by mentioning numbers that could only be known to a few people. I get it.
And all I'm saying is that a really sophisticated troll would look for some detail like that in the background of a NASA publicity photo as a way to fool you.
Noted, Dinah said, but I doubt it.
Who do you think it is, then?
Sean Probst, Dinah said. I think it's the Ymir expedition. Dube got a distracted look.
Man, I haven't thought about those guys in ages.
It was strange that a story as epic and as dramatic as the voyage of Ymir could go forgotten, but those were the times they lived in. The ship had stopped communicating and then disappeared against the backdrop of the sun, about a month after its departure from low Earth orbit, Leo, around day 126. A few sightings on optical telescopes had confirmed that it had transitioned into a helio.